nous nous retrouvons pour une série
consacrée. Nous attachons à quatre faits marquants de votre vie.
Passer une demi-heure ensemble pour.
Focus braque aujourd'hui son projecteur.
Focus. A program of Canal Academy. Listen to Marie-Laure Massey.
Good afternoon. Today we are going to talk about a movie. In October 2007, French cinema goers had the pleasure of discovering Jane, a film directed by Julien Jarrold, which was released in Great Britain in March 2007 under the much more interesting title Becoming Jane. This entertaining movie portrays the early love life of a monument of British literature, Jane Austen, who was born in December 1775 in Steventon, Hampshire, and who died in July 1817 in Winchester. Based on John Spence's biography, published in 2003 and entitled Becoming Jane Austen, Jane is a speculative biopic of Austen's presumed romance with the young Irish lawyer Thomas Lefroy, which took place around Christmas 1795. Anne Hathaway was chosen to play the lead. This American actress definitely entered the mature phase of her career with her role in The Devil Wears Prada, starring opposite Meryl Streep in 2006. The hero, Thomas Lefroy, is played by the rising Scots actor James McAvoy, who made a brilliant performance in The Last King of Scotland in 2006. So first, let's talk about the plot. Jane Austen is the younger daughter of Reverend George Austen, played by James Cromwell, and his wife, portrayed by Julie Walters, who belong to the impoverished country gentry. Like Mrs. Bennet in Pride and Prejudice, the business of Mrs. Austen's life is to get her daughters married, and well married if possible, especially Jane, since Cassandra is already engaged to Tom Fowle. Thus, the second sentence in the film is Mrs. Austen's exclamation, "That girl needs a husband," which obviously means a suitable husband. But at the beginning of the film, the 20-year-old Jane is only interested in literature. Therefore, she refuses the marriage proposal of Mr. Wisley, the nephew of the aristocratic and haughty Lady Gresham, played by Maggie Smith, and reminding us of Lady Catherine de Bourgh. Like Eliza Bennet in Pride and Prejudice, Jane begins to take marriage seriously only after she encounters Tom Lefroy, a promising lawyer with a reputation. Entirely dependent upon the will of his uncle and benefactor, a wealthy judge, played by the late Ian Richardson, Tom Lefroy has just been sent to the country to visit relatives and ponder over his misconduct in town. Jane has a very bad first impression of him, which, by the way, accounts for Pride and Prejudice's original title, First Impressions. So Jane cannot stand the self-centered young man, portrayed as a dissipated, arrogant, and impertinent rogue. Even if Tom first sneers at Jane's country ways and ingenuous prose, he then gets to know her and they fall in love. Tom takes Jane to London to try and convince his uncle, the judge, to let him marry the woman he loves. The judge considers it, but after receiving a treacherous letter informing him of Jane's poor family, he refuses. If Tom marries Jane, he will be disinherited. The lovers first part, but then Tom asks Jane to elope with him. As they're on their way to Scotland, she discovers that Tom's parents, along with his numerous siblings, depend upon the judge's allowance to survive. Jane's strong sense of duty makes her end her affair with Tom. She returns home to her family and begins to write Pride and Prejudice as First Impressions. Now, what do we really know about Jane and Tom's love story? Well, we don't know much about this love story, First, because Jane's sister Cassandra destroyed the greater part and the most confidential passages of her sister's letters in which this relationship was mentioned. Second, because their romance was very brief and probably had nothing to do with what happens in the film. What we do know is that Tom Lefroy is the chief subject of Jane Austen's earliest surviving letter to Cassandra, dated January the 10th, 1796. Quote, "You scold me so much in the nice long letter which I have this moment received from you, that I'm almost afraid to tell you how my Irish friend and I behaved. Imagine to yourself everything most profligate and shocking in the way of dancing and sitting down together. I can expose myself, however, only once more, because he leaves the country soon after next Friday. He's a very gentlemanlike, good-looking, pleasant young man, I assure you. He's a very great admirer of Tom Jones." This reference is very meaningful, because Henry Fielding's Tom Jones, published in 1749, was a very provocative and indecent novel, dealing with sexual attraction, fornication, and the sins of the flesh, very far from the notion of propriety that was to guide and inspire young women, especially a parson's daughter. This particular reference thus shows that Jane and Tom had a very bold, free, and even subversive conversation. As to Jane's expectations and feelings for Tom, here is what she writes to Cassandra on January the 14th as she prepares for her next ball. Quote, "I look forward with great impatience to it, as I rather expect to receive an offer from my friend in the course of the evening. I shall refuse him, however, unless he promises to give away his white coat." The end of the sentence is very unexpected, but this twist is so like her, being probably part of her system of defenses. She knew that her flirtation with Tom was not harmless, that she would suffer, so in her letter to Cassandra, she jokes about her other admirers and enjoys contradicting herself with another enigmatic sentence. Quote, "I mean to confine myself in future to Mr. Tom Lefroy, for whom I don't care a sixpence." Off quote. Here is a very ironical statement intended as a joke for Cassandra to put love and pain at a distance. But the very presence of the money reference reveals the core of the problem, how money and love are desperately intertwined. Even if it's a joke, the joke is undermined when you look back at the preceding letter where she praised so much the gentlemanlike, good-looking, pleasant young man. As Jane ends her letter on Friday the 15th, she cannot help expressing her grief. Quote, "At length, the day is come on which I'm to flirt my last with Tom Lefroy, and when you receive this, it will be over. My tears flow as I write at the melancholy idea." This letter is really significant because, as Claire Tomlin cleverly points out in her biography, it's the only surviving letter in which Jane is clearly writing as the heroine of her own youthful story, living for herself the short period of power, excitement, and adventure that might come to a young woman when she was thinking of choosing a husband. So Jane definitely flirted with the dazzling Tom Lefroy, who was so unlike the dancing partners she had known all her life. But she certainly did not elope with him. It's true that an engagement between them was out of the question, since both were penniless and brought up to sacrifice love if it ran counter to family approval. Besides, Tom's father himself had made an unwise marriage, that is, a marriage to an impoverished woman, and they had many mouths to feed. They had 5 daughters, which meant that the expectations of the whole family depended on Tom, the eldest son. He had to be successful to help his numerous sisters, but his own future depended on the will of a great uncle who was financing his law studies in London. Thus, when it became obvious to the Lefroys that Tom and Jane were falling in love, Tom was sent smartly away, according to Claire Tomlin in her biography, so that no more mischief might be done. Tom certainly came back to Hampshire once or twice, but the Lefroys made sure that he could not meet Jane. In November 1798, 3 years after their brief flirtation, Jane informs Cassandra that Mrs. Lefroy called on them, but said nothing of her nephew. And I quote, "As I was too proud to make any inquiries, my father's afterwards asking where he was, quote, "and I was too proud to make any inquiries. But on my father's afterwards asking where he was, I learned that he was gone back to London on his way to Ireland, where he's called to the bar and means to practice." So Jane never saw him after his Christmas visit of 1795. Even if Jane jokes about him in her letters, it must have been a very painful experience, first because she seemed really attached to him, and second because marriage was, at the time, the crowning point of a woman's life, and sometimes a way out of poverty. As expected, Tom finally married an heiress, had 7 children, and became Lord Chief Justice of Ireland in 1852. He also sat for 11 years in Parliament as a Tory. As an old man, he did confess to a nephew that he loved Jane Austen in 1796, although he qualifies the confession by saying it was boyish love. This cruel episode must have taught Jane Austen a hard lesson. She could never marry the man of her choice without money, but she would never marry without affection, a motto which runs counter to Mrs. Austen's desperate statement in the film, as Jane has just turned down an interesting marriage proposal. Quote, "Affection is highly desirable, Jane, but money is absolutely indispensable, indispensable to Jane, but also to the future of her mother after Mr. Austen's death." After Tom's departure, Jane Austen turned to writing, more determined than before to become a professional writer, making money out of her novels. In the same letter in which Jane expected a proposal from Tom on January the 15th, 1796, she made a very significant comment as Cassandra praised her on her writing. Quote, "I'm very much flattered by your commendation of my last letter, for I write only for fame and without any view to pecuniary emolument." Off quote. After her aborted marriage plans, she would change her mind and try to make all the money she could out of her novels. "I'm very greedy and want to make the most of it," she confesses to Cassandra in 1814, after the first edition of her new novel, Mansfield Park, was sold. Now, what about the screen adaptation? Well, the choice of Anne Hathaway was much criticised by the Janeites, these enthusiastic admirers of Jane Austen's writing. As a Guardian columnist remarked when the film was released in Britain, quote, "The idea that this extravagantly beautiful American should be entrusted with the task of playing the home county spinster who wrote all their favorite novels must seem like the worst kind of Hollywood blasphemy." Indeed, Hathaway, herself an Austen fanatic, admits that she was nervous about taking the role for precisely that reason. Some critics still consider that the young actress was a bit too inexperienced to convey Austen's complex personality. Besides, as she definitely looks beautiful, she's not very likely to embrace spinsterhood at the end. As we can expect, the choice of Hathaway was purely commercial. Hollywood producers just wanted to make sure that the actress would appeal to the widest audience possible, even bring in a young teen audience. But by the way, what do we know about Jane Austen's physical appearance? The main problem is that she is, along with her handicapped brother George, the only member of her family not to have any formal portrait. The only thing we have is a rather unflattering sketch drawn by her sister Cassandra, so unflattering that the managing director of Wordsworth Editions, publisher of classic novels, also defended its decision to show an improved or prettified Austen on its covers, offering the following explanation, I quote, "The poor soul didn't have anything going for her in the way of looks." However, here is what James Edward Austen Leigh wrote in 1871 about his aunt's physical appearance. Quote, "In person, she was very attractive. Her figure was rather tall and slender, her step light and firm, and her whole appearance expressive of health and animation. She had full round cheeks, bright hazel eyes, and brown hair forming natural curls close round her face." So, is Hathaway a Becoming Jane in the end? The original title of the film, Becoming Jane, is much more interesting than its bland French equivalent, Jane. It is indeed based on the title of John Spence's biography, Becoming Jane Austen, in which the gerund becoming clearly hints at a process of transformation, that is, the maturing of Austen, both as a woman and novelist, after her brief romance with Tom Lefroy. But there is more to it than meets the eye, because this title is also intended as a pun, mainly addressed to the Janeites, in which the gerund may also be read as an adjective. To Julian Jarrold, the actress he chose is a very becoming Jane indeed, in the sense that she is a very proper and decent embodiment of Austen. By the way, to reassure the Janeites and prove that she had the highest esteem for their icon, Hathaway trained very hard. She learned how to speak in a British accent, she changed her manners, read a few biographies to get a thorough knowledge of the novelist. Anyway, with such a name, apparently intended as a deliberate homage to William Shakespeare's wife by her theatre-loving parents, Anne Hathaway could not but play the role of a great figure of British literature. So, on the whole, yes, Anne Hathaway may be a bit too pretty and doe-eyed indeed, especially on the commercial poster, but she is no Calamity Jane at all. She is a committed Jane Austen. Her interpretation of Austen's wit, liveliness, energy and independence of mind is quite convincing and in keeping with an Elizabeth Bennet, Austen's emblematic heroine, who is not afraid of jumping over stiles and springing over puddles with impatient activity to go and nurse her ill sister. We mustn't forget that the idea of a Jane Austen as an old spinster chained to conventions as Dear Aunt Jane is a Victorian construction worlds apart from the lively, noisy, wild Jane who plays cricket in the film, who enjoyed being most profligate and shocking in real life. And indeed, here is what Jane Austen wrote to her niece Fanny Knight in 1817. I quote, "Pictures of perfection, as you know, make me sick and wicked," off quote. Quite a revealing statement. So now, is it a convincing movie? Well, James McAvoy is definitely a good actor, but perhaps not dashing or romantic enough to be completely convincing. He nonetheless has a very nice rapport with Hathaway. They form a very nice couple. But it's very difficult to believe in the end of the story. It just doesn't pan out as we would expect given such a beginning. However, as a very entertaining fiction film, it is well intended. Jane Austen fans should really enjoy the numerous references to Persuasion, Sense and Sensibility, and Pride and Prejudice, since we notice an interesting system of echoes between the film and the novels. We even have the impression of watching another adaptation of an Austen novel, with all the familiar themes like propriety versus passion, and familiar characters, the snobbish aristocrat, the matchmaking mother, the poor heroine, except that here the lead character is Austen playing an Austen heroine. The most delightful aspects of the film lie in the wistful atmosphere, the aesthetic pictures and beautiful Irish scenery, since the film was largely shot in Ireland, incidentally Tom Lefroy's country. In the end, what matters is not so much Jane Austen's looks or physical appearance, and indeed, do we really want to know what she looked like? This will hopefully remain a mystery forever. What matters is not her aborted love story either, because we readers are relieved that she won at literature instead of at love. As she declared in one of her letters, I quote, "Composition seems to me impossible with a head full of joints of mutton and doses of rhubarb," unquote. And had she married, her head would certainly have been full of household duties. It would probably be simplistic and Manichaean to claim, along with the filmmakers, that young and passionate Jane became the mature and witty novelist, mainly thanks to her romance with Tom Lefroy. As Tom advises her in the film, I quote, "If you wish to practice the art of fiction, experience is vital. Your horizons must be widened." Well, this episode was probably a source of inspiration for her novels, especially as to the central role of money in her plots. We mustn't forget that the money issue accounts for Austen's blighted marriage prospects. Her vision of life certainly became informed by this unhappy love, as she became aware of sexual vulnerability. But what she definitely did not owe Lefroy was her deep sense of irony and sharp insight into human nature. Rather, what definitely matters in this film is that it helps us understand how disappointed love led to a kind of compensation in fiction through the creation of successful heroines, how pain and sorrow paradoxically gave birth to the light and bright and sparkling Pride and Prejudice, one of the most enticing and thrilling novels in British literature. If we come to think of it, the real hero of the film may not be Tom Lefroy at all, but Jane Austen's manuscript. And it's very fitting and even becoming that the last scene of the film be a reading of the very beginning of Pride and Prejudice by the novelist herself. Like a mise en abîme, the filmic representation of Jane Austen's love life thus naturally and harmoniously flows into another form of art with another fiction, but this time crowned by a happy end. At that stage, we cannot but remember Joe Wright's 2005 screen adaptation of the novel, starring Keira Knightley, standing out against a perfect English landscape, a novel in her hand. One last word. You should know that several adaptations of Jane Austen's novels are due in 2008, which will enable us to admire Jane Austen's works once more. But of course, to make the most of it, you should first read her novels. Thanks for listening to Canal Académie.